Generally speaking, are you satisfied with the response from the federal government?
I'm not satisfied with the response from the federal government. There has been a total lack of communication, especially between our federal officials and our state officials. At the outset, our airport manager didn't even know that we were designated as a port of entry until the press release was issued. There were actually planes in the air while we were having a conference call with federal officials to determine what our protocols, our locations, our staffing structures would be relative to our quarantine process. Because we have such a great Department of Health and an infectious disease prevention branch, we've picked up the slack locally, and so everybody needs to know that we're safe, but none of that is thanks to the Trump White House. They have been disorganized from the start, and they've defunded the CDC in their coming budget, so that sort of gives you an indication of how they prioritize public health and especially the prevention of a pandemic.
That was going to be my next question. I understand that that budget request was put in and it actually cut funding pretty substantially for the unit of the CDC that deals with this type of event. What is the view from Capitol Hill amongst you and your colleagues about that request?
Well, the first thing is it's absurd. We're in the middle of a potential pandemic and we're mobilizing a response, and they propose a budget that's a 9% overall cut to the CDC, but specifically they zero out the budgets for the prevention of global pandemics, which is just out of control, bad idea. We will reject that on a bipartisan basis. I have no doubt about that. The president's budget will be rejected sort of more generally, but specifically as it relates to this, I have no doubt that on a bipartisan basis, we're going to fund these agencies and probably even increase their funding over time.
One of the issues that's been prominent here locally is the delay in getting test kits for the coronavirus. Is there any kind of update you can provide on that issue?
The latest is that the CDC has to go back to the manufacturer and remanufacture these test kits. And they're telling us that it will be mid-March before the test kits are available. We're trying to see whether they can get them out quicker than that. Failing that, we're pursuing whether or not it's possible for the Japanese government to share a test kit or two with us. We've reached out to the embassy, and the CDC is trying to determine whether the standards are the same. So that may be a workaround in the short run. And then finally, they're telling us that even if we send a swab to the CDC headquarters in Atlanta, that it'll take 7 days to get a determination. And that actually makes no sense either, because obviously you could fly an object to Atlanta overnight, 7-8 hours, and then it takes about 4 hours to conduct the test. So in my own judgment, this shouldn't take more than a day or two, even if we're not in possession of the test kits. There's no reason to assume it ought to take a week to get a result.
Are these issues stemming from the fact that this is a new virus, or are they indicative of some larger problem within the federal government, do you think?
It's a good question. So, listen, coming up with the reagent, which is the sort of test, is something that they're certainly doing as fast as they can. And you can't have this thing ready-made because it's made for this particular virus. So CDC and NIH are moving as fast as they can. And so some of that is an understandable scramble to catch up with the epidemiology of a particular disease that's new. But there are aspects of this that are, frankly speaking, the administration's fault. Defunding the CDC is one of them. Defunding the specific programs that have to deal with pandemics is another. But not filling the position at the National Security Council that deals with global pandemics is inexcusable. And they spent a couple of years not filling the position. And then they went ahead and just said, you know what, we're going to eliminate this role. And so what that means as a practical matter is that you don't have any one person who operates out of the White House with the authority of the president to kind of make sure that between all of the executive branch agencies, that they're working together and talking to each other. You now have one cabinet secretary trying to boss around other cabinet secretaries, and that doesn't really work. This is why the idea of a czar is actually smart. It may sound a little funny, but the Obama administration appointed an Ebola czar for this very reason. And it was criticized because everyone says, well, look, don't we have cabinet secretaries for that? But the specific role is coordination between agencies and across the whole of government. And nobody's doing that right now in the federal government.
You've been advocating for federal reimbursement for state costs like have been incurred here in Hawaii. How confident are you that that will come through?
I don't know. I can't report to you sort of my level of confidence because right now there are potential revenue streams and there are sort of buckets of money from which we think the Department of Health is and the department local Department of Defense is potentially going to be reimbursed. But we don't know that for sure. So a number of us have written a letter to the Secretary of HHS to determine what are these reimbursement streams. Now, state government locally has not allowed that to stop them from doing what is necessary. But as this problem wears on, even if it hopefully doesn't get any worse, it's starting to cost real money. I mean, a reallocation of staff time for a few days or even a week or two is one thing, but this actually costs cash. And this is a federal role, and the federal government should reimburse our state and local government.
Shifting gears a little bit, another issue coming up pretty soon that you've been very vocal about is the census. When last we spoke, preparations were just getting underway locally to hire census workers and get the word out about the census. How are you feeling about the census as we get closer to Census Day?
I'm feeling optimistic, but not overconfident. This is an enormous enterprise. And you always deal with the challenges of finding people geographically where they may be difficult to find. And then nowadays you have a sort of a new layer of concern in terms of what people may do with the data. So I do want to reassure folks that the census data is totally confidential. It can't be used for law enforcement purposes. It can't be sent over to the Customs and Border Protection or anything like that. But we do have some education to do, not just in terms of people understanding that their data is safe and that it won't be used against them, but also the importance of making sure that everybody in Hawaii is counted, whether you're elderly individual, whether you've lived in Hawaii all your life, whether you just moved here, whether you're from France or anywhere else. Every person in the country is to be counted. Not every citizen, not every voter. Every human being living in the country is to be counted. And the reason that matters so much for Hawaii is that there's a lot of money that flows to the state of Hawaii based on a formula. And they just simply count up the number of people in Hawaii and multiply that by the formula. And that's how much money we might get for a health program, an education program, a transportation program. And so the more we maximize our count, the more we maximize our dollars.
What concerns about getting the actual count done have you been hearing from local organizations in the last few weeks and months?
Well, I think they're focused on the right things. And I sort of, you know, I want to make sure that everybody understands this is going reasonably well. A couple of challenges. Hiring census workers in a sort of tight labor market has been a challenge. They bumped up the rate to $15, but it's still a tight labor market and they haven't hired everybody they need to. And then we've got to work with the community organizations to just get the word out verbally to everybody. We've got to make sure that there is sufficient language proficiency so that people don't end up at the door and unable to sort of complete the form. And then I think, you know, on the upside, one of the great advantages this census versus any time in the past is that for the very first time, you're going to be able to complete the form online. So if you don't want to be bothered by somebody knocking on your door, and frankly, if you want to save the Census Bureau some resources and time, just once it's live, go to census.gov, fill it out, and you're pow, you're done. And you don't have to have people come back and back and back and say, how many people live here? Can I get some more details? You just do it and you're done. And so to me, I think that's from a resource standpoint, better for everybody.
You work a lot on military issues at the Capitol, and the Trump administration recently announced it was going to divert several billion dollars away from the military and military procurement to fund the border wall on the southern border. What's your reaction to that announcement?
Well, it's pure politics, and what I mean by that is that I think it's, listen, I oppose the wall on public policy grounds. But it's important to know that they're not even really building the wall. They've only been able to expend $600 million of the six-odd billion that they've raided from military construction. And now they're talking about raiding another $7 billion. So if you add up all the money for the wall, or theoretical money for the wall, it's around $15 billion. But the rate-limiting factor, right, the thing that's going to slow this down is not how much money has been diverted or appropriated, but rather that this stuff's hard. And once you get out of certain parts of Arizona and Southern California, you're into really difficult terrain in southern border of Texas. And so you're going to have to do eminent domain. You're going to have to condemn private property, mostly cattle ranchers, and you're going to end up in lawsuits. And then not only that, but the terrain itself is super difficult because the Rio Grande Valley, is just not an easy place to do construction. And so they're stuck because this thing is a bad idea. But it's very clear to me that they just want to show a big number so that Trump can talk about it in his rallies. The unfortunate thing is that this money is coming from, you know, not every aspect of the military budget makes sense, and not every aspect of the military budget ought to be funded at the level that it's funded. But MILCON, military construction, is generally speaking really well-vetted stuff. We're talking about barracks. We're talking about airplane hangars. We're talking about military housing for families. We're talking about the kind of stuff that is really needed. This isn't money that goes to some big weapon system that may cost $30 billion. This is stuff that comes to us from the service branches and actually up through the garrisons. So, you know, whether it's Fort Shafter or Fort DeRussy or whatever it is, Camp Smith and all of those folks come in and they say, these are our more urgent needs. And then that gets worked up through a process. So I can tell you for certain that that military construction budget does not have a lot of waste in it. It's not like other parts of the military budget where you could sort of make an argument that we really need to drive down costs. This is stuff that our service members and their families really need, and it's being raided just so that the president can say we're already building the wall.
Do you have any indication if Hawaii facilities will be impacted by that diversion of funds?
We have the last round of raiding was bad but not horrible for the state of Hawaii. If I remember correctly, one of the things that was zeroed out was a security gate at the Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station, which is certainly not a trivial thing, but something that we'll try to get back in the budget over time. But nothing major, not at the Joint Bases Pearl Harbor Hickam, nothing at PMRF, nothing that we find essential in the next couple of years.
You recently held a hearing or co-convened a hearing dealing with the national security impacts of climate change, and military construction and base construction was one of the main topics at that hearing. Could you elaborate a little bit about what you learned and what your takeaways from that were?
Well, the interesting thing about the Department of Defense is that, you know, they have to deal with what is, not what they wish were occurring. And so when they do their analysis about climate change, as much as I think it's fair to say the DOD is a sort of a conservative organization, they're still a fact-based organization, and they're dealing with climate realities. And so in their construction and renovation and planning processes, they've pretty much integrated the fact of climate change into what they're doing with bases and installations. So in some places, that's simple. You just have to make a place hurricane ready. In some places, you may end up having to do, you know, managed retreat, which means, you know, essentially getting away from the coastline. We're fortunate because most of our bases and installations, although they'll be impacted by climate change, are not likely to, you know, experiencing the kind of flooding that you'd see, say, in Norfolk, Virginia, and other places, and all over Florida. But it was just interesting to me that anybody who is in the business of dealing with what is, as opposed to, you know, theoretical political arguments, just understands that climate change is not a future problem, and it's not a political problem. It's a now thing, and they have to account for it.
You pointed out in that hearing that there are tremendous political obstacles to relocating a military base. Could you expound on that a little bit? And you argued that perhaps we should consider relocating a base that was severely damaged a few years ago.
Yeah, the Tyndall Air Force Base was essentially demolished by a hurricane. And, you know, Mike Pence got on a plane with Rick Scott, and essentially they promised to rebuild the base. And I objected to it, not necessarily because I disagreed with rebuilding the base, but because the whole structure of determining who decides where things get built was sort of taken away from Congress because, frankly, it was a little too much horse trading, a little too much politics. And so the service branches determine what their needs are. And this was essentially two politicians cutting a deal. And I said, hold on a second. We got to go through the normal process of your analysis. Not only that, but there's no indication that if you rebuild Tyndall Air Force Base, that it's not remaining vulnerable to being essentially demolished by another hurricane. And so I fought that fight. I did not win. But I think over time, we're going to start to recognize, and this goes for the Federal Emergency Management Agency too, we can't keep building and rebuilding the same town over and over again. So as climate change becomes more understood, we're going to have to look at our costs and say, look, if this, you know, if this is your third time being demolished, then maybe the federal government is not going to cover the cost of you guys rebuilding in the same way, in the same place.
Do you think that shift is underway, whether for military facilities or private property?
I think that shift is underway conceptually, but where the rubber hits the road is at the, you know, at the political level. And so we're fighting that fight as we speak. FEMA is very much, you know, they were sort of resistant to integrating climate-oriented thinking because they said, you know, listen, we're disaster prep, disaster response, disaster recovery. But now they realize in the recovery phase, and when you help a community to rebuild, you've at least got to require that they rebuild in such a fashion where if you had the same weather event happen again, that they'd be more resilient. They used to say you may only build to the original specs, which sort of is like a fiscal control, right? We don't want you to get a fancy version of your town or your port or your bus depot or whatever. But now they're realizing, listen, it doesn't save us any money for you guys to rebuild it stupidly. So if you want to rebuild this with hurricane clips, and if you want to, you know, move 100 yards back from the coastline, if you want to do those things that will make your town or your base more resilient, that actually saves the taxpayer dollar.
The impeachment of President Trump is now firmly in the rearview mirror. You've had a few weeks to recover from that and maybe reflect on it. Could you share with us what it was like to be in the chamber during that trial?
Well, it was a weighty experience. You know, you get sworn in as a judge, not a juror really, but a judge. And, you know, on penalty of imprisonment, you're there to be silent and no one's got their phones. And we just sat there and listened. And I thought Adam Schiff was extraordinary. I think that in this age of sort of social media and, you know, the cable news hits and all the rest of it in the middle of a presidential primary, I believe Adam Schiff laid down a marker, and I think with the benefit of hindsight, say 20 or 30 years from now, he will look like a major historical figure because of the speeches that he made and the way he conducted himself. So that was extraordinarily impressive. I was super proud of my friend and colleague, Mitt Romney. He has become a friend. I do admire him tremendously, and he showed great courage. And I was personally disappointed with several of my Republican colleagues with whom I've, you know, normally have a reasonable working relationship. But, you know, it's sad to see because they know who the president is and they have just made a judgment that they're not in a position to stand up to him. And that is, on a personal note, disappointing, but also it, you know, it augurs. I would just say it's a little more than concerning for the country, because we've got, first of all, my judgment is we really got to beat this guy. But in the meantime, you know, we still have 8 months of the Trump presidency, and he does not appear to be in any way constrained or as Susan Collins said, in any way to have learned his lesson. And I think if anything, he learned the lesson that he gets to operate with impunity as long as Mitch McConnell's running the Senate.
There was recently a bipartisan vote in the Senate to constrain the president's power to use military force against Iran. What do you think allowed a bipartisan consensus to be reached so soon after this very bitterly divisive vote?
Okay, so I'm not usually this cynical. I just want to say this, but count me as underwhelmed by that resolution. And here's why. First of all, even if we had passed it with a veto-proof majority, and we didn't, the president will claim Article II powers that supersede anything that we could pass as a resolution. So it's good that we laid down a marker, said no war with Iran without coming to Congress. But the president very clearly himself, through, you know, he said, I've got an Article 2, I can do whatever I want. And his lawyers, Alan Dershowitz and Jay Sekulow, have asserted that Article 2 is an almost total power. And so if we want to stop the president from getting into a war with Iran, we have to stop the president from getting into a war with Iran. And we have to really use our leverage in the way that legislative branches actually do at the county and state level. Like, we have to think in terms of constitutional hardball, not in terms of essentially a resolution passed that doesn't have the weight of federal law that just says, please don't do this. This is our authority. And I'm just not into, I mean, I voted, obviously, to constrain the president's authority, but I'm just somewhat underwhelmed by any time that we announce that we're going to reiterate authorities that we already have, because the way to show power is to perhaps hold up the National Defense Authorization. But there are ways to exert leverage that exceed just a war powers resolution, which will no doubt be ignored by the president.
Do you think there is a shift in the balance of power back toward the Congress in kind of at least reversing or somewhat moderating a trend that's been underway for decades now?
Only if we win. I really mean that. I think that that legislators generally are not as ferocious in guarding their prerogatives institutionally as they used to. And I don't know if that's cable news or polarization or what, but I'm, you know, sort of new to the Senate, but I'm old school in that particular way. I think it is, if you are in the executive branch, your one of your obligations, in addition to the Constitution, is to advocate for your branch of government. And I think the legislative branch ought to do that too. You know, the framers wanted the branches to be in a constant tug of war for power, and we've just sort of let go of the rope. And I think that that has to change.
Do you think there will be a movement in that direction, or will it always be the party who controls the White House and also Congress sort of allows the executive to take more rope?
I don't know how to predict that, but I am hopeful that over time, if we see that executives of who belong to the Democratic Party and executives who belong to the Republican Party exceed our perception of where their constitutional authority lies, then, you know, if we get a couple of presidencies of each party where they're sort of making the legislative branch less and less relevant, then maybe we can get some bipartisan moments where the sort of mouse roars. But so far, not so good on the legislature standing up for itself.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention?
Just that we are actually making a progress on climate change, and it's in a specific area. The financial services sector is having to increasingly report climate risk on all of their disclosures. And I've been working really, really hard on this for the last couple of years. But the Federal Reserve, the Securities and Exchange Commission, something called the CFTC, the Commodities Future Trading Commission, all of these agencies that oversee parts of the financial sector, kind of like the DOD, are in no position to ignore climate because they really need to know the data. And investors, whether they're individual investors or institutional investors, pension fund or whomever they are, they got to know whether a particular investment vehicle is extra vulnerable to climate impacts. And right now, none of that data is being collected and reported. And over the last 6 months or so, believe it or not, this Fed and this SEC have made tremendous progress. The private sector, the rating agencies want to see these data sets as well. And so I think markets are going to respond more quickly to the reality of climate change than the Congress will. So that's good news, because people are starting to realize that climate change is not a future problem. It's a now problem.
Senator Brian Schatz, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.